Folks, last week there were a number of stories reported about permitting issues relative to liquor licenses and the difficulties that folks were having, and they didn't realize they were generating fines and things of that nature. The New Orleans City Council back in the spring had made some modifications to try and assist ABO license holders then, but yet problems still are cropping up. And Freddie King, New Orleans City Council member, was supposed to join us Friday. He got tied up, and we understand that. He agreed to come back on this morning, so we're happy to have him. Freddie, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Newell. Thanks for having me.
So, Freddie, if you would, what seems to be the issue? Because you guys on the council tried really hard to address some other issues that came up in the spring and actually put them in place. And it sounds to me like part of this, that the regulatory side of this is circumventing even some of that of what y'all put in place. Is that true?
That's true, Newell. Through my leadership, we introduced legislation that would make it a bit more helpful for our small businesses to get a temporary license, such as Plume. Those ideas were rejected by safety and permits. They had their own ideas of how things should go, basically. And had they adopted what was put in place or was suggested to them back in March, this would not be an issue, and you wouldn't have small businesses around the city, a small business like Plume, having this huge fine because they would have been able to get a temporary ABO and continue to operate how they've been operating. But this has been an issue with safety and permits for quite some time before I took office. Newell, it seems that the human element is taken out of some of the rules and regulations. You have a business like Plume, who's the typical mom and pop business. They are a mom and pop. They live across the street. Their child goes to nursery, to daycare, next to their home. They invested into the community, and because they made an honest mistake and did not renew their city license, their city liquor license. They renewed their state license, but they didn't renew their city license. They're being punished, and it may seem like something small, but to a small business in a small restaurant in the summer, which is a very slow time, being fined thousands of dollars could put them in the poorhouse and bankrupt them, and that's what they're saying. So our office fully supports Plume and all of those small businesses who are having these struggles. But we're just trying to put some common sense rules in place, not to help those bad actors, but to help those good actors who really need help.
Freddie, it seems to me that a lot of this licensing doesn't align. It all goes back to the inception date of when you apply, when it gets approved, and I guess the annual period starts from there. Is that correct?
Yes, it doesn't align, and it's also confusing because you have the state. You have the state liquor license. You have a city liquor license. They don't always align. Like in Plume's situation, they kept renewing their state license. They were giving a notice from the state, a proper notice that, hey, it's time to renew. The city didn't do that. The city gave them an email at an email account that they didn't check regularly, or they hadn't checked or used in a long time. So they really didn't know that, hey, it's time to renew that license. And you know, dude, I'm from a small business. I own a small business. My wife and I grew up in a household that had a small business. When you got to make payroll, when you have to supply overhead, pay mortgage, some of those small things or some of those running the business things, like renewing the license, they could come sometimes slip through the cracks. And the city does a bad job. The safety and permits department specifically, in my opinion, does a bad job of really helping those small businesses. It's more punitive, and that can really devastate a city, especially a city like ours that really relies on small businesses.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about the collection of sales taxes, which is critical to the financing of government services. What's interesting, Freddie, is that there's so many other times that other departments, I guess, and I don't know, who handles occupational license taxes for the city? Is it safety and permits? Probably not. It's probably the revenue department.
I believe that's the revenue department, yeah.
Why not have all of these things aligned? Like, you know, occupational license and your liquor permits. If, you know, you apply in July, why not issue them, an 18-month or a 6-month license, and then it aligns with occupational license? Because get the benefit and the leverage. Everybody's mailing these notices out. Put them all in one envelope. I mean, it can't be that hard, right?
Here's the thing. The ABO license wasn't mailed out. It was sent via email. So they didn't even
that's not a good way of doing this. I mean, right?
Exactly. And here's something else, Lou. You mentioned the sales tax. So let's just say, worst case scenario, this company, this restaurant, they can't pay the fines. Now their business has to close down. Now they have to move out of the neighborhood that they invested a lot of money in. So you have an empty restaurant, you have an empty house, just because the city, I believe, was a bit too punitive and really didn't take that extra step to help a small business. So that's that human element that we sometimes forget that's real important. And what puzzles me is we have truly bad actors like Iggy's in the Marini that has that's hundreds of video footage of all types of alcohol related issues happening, customers leaving, drinking and driving, running into parked cars, illicit sales happening, and their ABO license continues to get renewed after I said please don't renew it, after the Marini residents said please don't renew it. So if we take that energy and focus and hitting the bad actors the way we punish the people who are really bringing a benefit to our community, we'll be in better shape.
Well, that's when your regulatory agencies run amok, right? I mean, you know, regulatory agencies really ought to be there to create an environment, an atmosphere, a landscape for businesses to succeed. You know, not to be unsuccessful. And if they made an honest mistake, as you pointed out several times already in this interview, why do you have to be so punitive? I mean, you know, the interesting thing, especially in the most compelling evidence, is they paid the state license. They just simply forgot to pay the city license. So it wasn't like they were trying to shirk their responsibility, right?
Exactly. I believe it could be too robotic. Like the Terminator, we just have a goal as a city, and if you run afoul and you don't check out all the boxes, we lose sight of the human element. These are humans who have to juggle a business, raising a family, raising a child, and so you know they missed paying the city. Like you said, they didn't miss paying the state, so it wasn't like they was trying to circumvent the rules. Well, we just, again, make it too hard, not with just ABO licenses, but the whole safety and permits. I talk to home builders all the time, and they said we just don't like to build in Orleans Parish because the same time we put a permit in a neighboring parish at the same time as Orleans, our foundation is ready to be built, is ready in the neighboring parish, but we're still stuck in safety and permits in Orleans Parish. I talked to a grocery store owner, a local grocery store owner, who has at least one grocery store in Gentilly. And I said, hey, we have a food desert near the Algiers Point area. And he said, you know, Councilmember King, I've heard that before. I would love to move in that area, but I'm still fighting to get my permits in Gentilly. I'd rather just go to the next parish over because it's so much easier. Now, I get tired of hearing that. Because those losses, they add up, Noel, and eventually you start seeing your sales revenue dip, your tax revenue dip, your population dip, because people, they're getting frustrated with the red tape the hoops and the hurdles just to make it and just to run a small business in the city.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, that's the lifeline of a city, obviously, because without the generation of, you know, property taxes, sales taxes, occupational license taxes, all of this, you know, your ABO licensing and everything else, I mean, that's financing all of this. And without it, if you start to get diminished numbers and people closing down and finding out that it's easier to be more successful in other areas of the state, that's where they're going to go. That's human nature. They're going to take the path of least resistance. They're not going to continue to fight that fight and not make any money, right? I mean, you know, it's just and business is tough out there, you know, and everyone is competing against everyone. It's almost as if we don't even have the desire to compete. You got a lot of people. You guys are working hard, trying to make a difference, and yet you got other people that are – you're in a tug of war with your own administration.
You're absolutely right, Newell. I don't know if it's ego, if it's my way or no way, but something has to change. We're losing too many small businesses. We're losing too many businesses. Our population isn't growing. You know, we've had this conversation years ago about the difficulties in safety and permits, and unfortunately, some things have changed, but not enough. And I'll continue to fight to change safety and permits to make sure we get common sense rules in. Nothing that's going to help somebody break the rules, but things are going to help people pay their bills. Things are going to help people just make it easier to survive and make a dollar to this city. We don't want to hurt those businesses like Plume, but those businesses who are breaking the rules, who turn a blind eye when their customers make the neighborhood an unsafe place, we want to shut those businesses down. I think we can do both, but right now we aren't doing both. We're making it difficult for the good guys to succeed, and we're making it easy for the bad guys to keep swimming through the cracks, and that's not a good recipe for a successful city, a successful business economy in the city.
I got a text here that says maybe they should just get an ice chest and sell the alcohol in the street.
There you go. We talked about that ad nauseum. And you can do that and, you know, and sell other things. You know,
you could sell anything you want out of a red wagon.
I mean, there you go. Edibles, food. Again, we try to crack down on that on Bourbon Street in the Frenchman and on Frenchman Street in Marigny. And that was met with it's a certain level of resistance. You know, it's unfair, and we didn't call it talk about that, but it's unfair when you have a brick and mortar or somebody who's paying for a push cart, a legal push cart, to compete with somebody who's not paying overhead, who's not paying sales tax, who's not insured. We introduced legislation to allow for up to 20 more legal push carts. So there are legal avenues that our office has taken to make it possible, but it's unfair when I'm paying all of the taxes and overhead and I'm competing with somebody who is not paying anything and be selling it the same product at the same price. That just can't compete. You can't win like that.
But you see, that's emblematic of a dysfunctional regulatory agency, going back to what I said before of creating the landscape for those that are following the rules to be successful, is you eliminate those that don't follow the rules but that are eroding away the sales base of the legitimate businesses. And I don't know what it is in this city that we don't understand the basic principles of this, is that we cannot have a viable legal business community if we allow a flourishing illegal business community. I mean, it's
exactly. I agree, and that's why, again, we created legislation to give people that path forward to get legal. But you have to have the support of all of the city government to encourage everybody to walk in that path forward. When there's a break in the chain and everyone isn't marching to the same beat, it creates a space where the illegal activity will continue because you don't have that enforcement that you need for whatever reason. You don't have it. So the council, we can make all the rules. We can help people become legal all we want. If the enforcement arm isn't there, if it's not always encouraged to be there, then the rules we make aren't worth anything.
So what are the next steps? I mean, is the council just at this point feel totally impotent and they're not able to do anything?
Well, no, as relates to the plume situation, we're going to introduce legislation that's going to require more of an advance notice to say, hey, it's time to renew your license. So that's something that we're planning on doing. We rejected safety and permits. The council rejected safety and permits, new method of handling renewals. We told them basically go back to the drawing table, bring something back to the council that more in line with the vision of the ordinance that was passed back in the spring, as you mentioned earlier. So we're waiting to hear back from safety and permits as it relates to that. And ultimately, you know, we're going to have a new mayor in a couple months. So the council and this new mayor, whoever that may be, hopefully we can all work together and do something that brings this city forward. But the key word is working together. And I think we're going to get that accomplished moving forward.
Well, we will keep our fingers crossed in the interim, and thank you for joining us today. Sounds like you're all over this issue, and we appreciate that as well. Freddie King, New Orleans City Council member, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Folks, we talked a lot about the big, beautiful bill and its impact on the healthcare delivery system in this country, specifically about Medicaid and whether or not it would harm rural hospitals and other programs under the Medicaid umbrella. Joan Alker, executive director for the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy, joins us. Joan, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's have this conversation and kind of divide it up into two categories, immediate impact and ultimate impact, which would, let's say, 2 years down the road. Because as I read the bill, it seems to be a big differential and a somewhat of a delta between the two. Your thoughts?
Yeah, you make a good point. You know, the way I think about the bill is there are a lot of Medicaid cuts in here, a lot of different proposals, but there are sort of three buckets. The first are things which go into effect immediately. The second are proposals which go into effect right after the midterm elections. And the third is a set of proposals that go into effect after the next presidential election. So that's a little bit oversimplified, but, you know, these are politicians at work. They were worried about the Medicaid cuts being unpopular, and that's a lot of what we see here on the timelines.
So when we talk about immediate impacts, what would be examples of same?
So there are some immediate freezes on states' ability to raise their revenues through provider taxes, and that's going to really vary state by state. There's also some reductions in coverage for example, refugees and asylees. That's going to start fairly soon, not immediately, but fairly soon. So there's a handful of proposals, mostly, again, affecting states' ability to raise their share of the Medicaid costs, because it's a shared program with the federal government and the state, each paying some of the cost. Some of those provisions are more immediate.
How would you, a lot of folks are having difficulty in understanding this relationship, so to speak, between the federal and state government financing Medicaid. the program started out early onset where I guess it was a much different share breakdown than it is today as a result of Medicaid expansion. It seems to me the federal government has been very lenient in, you know, these provider tax programs being approved by CMS and others, but the cost of the program growing exponentially. What is one to do? How do we end up handling this? Because the clip that it's growing at is, I guess most people would agree, is not sustainable, right?
Yeah, those are great questions. So let me address the healthcare cost question first. So we have a huge problem in our country with healthcare costs going up, drug prices, really prices across the board. That's not a Medicaid problem per se, that's a healthcare system per se. And the reason Medicaid costs have been going up is because more people have been getting coverage as a consequence of the Affordable Care Act, and because we live in an aging society and Medicaid is the number one payer for long-term care. So these are huge challenges, the growing need for long-term care, the high cost of healthcare. Unfortunately, this bill won't address those challenges. It just cuts money out of Medicaid. Now, as to your second question as to why is the federal government paying 90 cents on the dollar for Affordable Care Act expansion adults, whereas, for example, for children, they're paying less on the dollar. So this really comes about as a consequence of when the Affordable Care Act passed, Congress thought, well, okay, we're trying to get here to a place where everybody has a path to coverage. You know, that was like 100 years it took to getting to a place where everybody had a path to health insurance, because as we all know, health insurance is really the price of admission to our healthcare system. I mean, there's just really nobody, unless you're, you know, extraordinarily wealthy, can afford to pay healthcare costs on your own. And Congress, as it turns out, rightly predicted that the Supreme Court would strike down anything that wasn't, that was essentially a mandate on states without the federal government picking up the vast share of the cost. And that is slightly oversimplified, but that is what happened. The Supreme Court struck down the mandatory nature of the Medicaid expansion, and it became optional. Of course, Louisiana is the state that has picked it up. But that's really the history of why the federal government is paying more. You know, I think it would be well worth looking at for the federal government to pay more for children as well. Children are a very good place that we should be spending money. They're not expensive to cover, and there's a great return on investment because these kids are our future. But that's another story.
So how do I guess my frustration is that there's a lot of rhetoric going around about beating on whatever bill comes out, whether it was the ACA or whether it's the big, beautiful bill, but not really a whole lot of discussion about solutions to this and how we correct this situation moving forward. You know, the work requirement, a lot of people are upset with that, but 2/3 of the recipients now work. It's just a question of figuring out an efficient way of accounting for that. Is it achievable? I mean, I keep hearing, you know, that Georgia was a disaster, Arkansas didn't go so well. It seems to me to be a fairly easy exercise. Why is all this so difficult?
Yeah, that's also a great question. Georgia has, I guess, sort of shockingly to me, been an extraordinarily expensive undertaking for taxpayers when it comes to setting up this complicated system. Because, you know, when we talk about the work requirement, and I'll just say, you know, I think it's perfectly reasonable for government to try to support work. This policy is not going to achieve that, because most people are already working, but more importantly, when you take away people's health insurance and access to health care, it makes it harder for them to work, not easier. And a lot of these folks are working in low-wage jobs that don't provide health coverage. That's the problem here. But what happened in Georgia was, you know, they have this very complicated system they had to set up because, of course, it's like, all right, we're going to have the work requirement, but you can get an exemption if you are, you know, medically frail or you have a substance use disorder or you're taking care of a relative. Well, that's like a lot of things the government has to know about you, really complicated set of issues and questions to figure out who passes and jumps these hurdles, right? And so what's happened in Georgia is that Deloitte, you know, a large international consulting firm, has gotten millions of dollars, and that's where most of the money has gone rather than paying for people's health care. So are there ways, and I know the administration is saying we're going to simplify this with an app. Well, okay. Not everybody has, particularly very poor people, has a phone that is they're going to be able to just download an app and report in on their substance use problems. So I think the technology can get better, but fundamentally, this policy just creates expensive red tape for the taxpayer. So I agree with you. I think it would be a lot better if we could start getting to solutions here. And the solutions really lie in addressing these, first of all, this gap that long-term care is not covered by Medicare, right? And so this is leaving the states holding the bag on this question, which is going to be very challenging. So that's something we've got to figure out as a country. And these rising healthcare costs more broadly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of the same pathway from my view that we've taken with public pensions, right? We let it run, and now we have these legacy costs that we can't afford any longer. And, you know, we continue to try, we're kicking the can down the road. We're not providing solutions. We're not providing alternatives. The legacy costs are going up. It's absolutely breaking the back of state and local government. And therefore, whenever there's an opportunity to go leverage or take advantage of some program that the federal government is offering, we abuse it, quite frankly, in my view, to the extent of we have these exotic financing schemes such as provider taxes, which was a workaround. I sat on a hospital board in excess of 20 years, and when they presented that scheme to me, I was like, well this sounds like a, you know, something that I would be investigating people for, because I was actually in law enforcement. I was a sheriff in this parish, and you know, I was looking at it. I was like, we actually deferred a year before we actually did it because we couldn't believe that it was true, that it was going to work this way and that CMS would actually embrace it. Turns out they did, and we lost, you know, probably $16, $17 million by waiting that year. But, you know, we were extremely uncertain and uneasy about it. But that kind of gives you a flavor, you know, of what healthcare folks are going through and trying to do this. And I just got to believe that there's a more direct approach to this, and that we're overcomplicating this whole process. And I happen to believe that one of the ways is what we give tax write-offs for everything. Why wouldn't we give small employers, you know, huge abilities to write off their corporate taxes and so forth if they offer health care to their employees, and, you know, and publicly finance it that way? We seem to be able to hold that system together. It's got its issues, but a lot better than most of these other exotic schemes that we're involved in.
Well, we certainly have probably the most complicated healthcare system in the world. I would agree with you there, and that is not very efficient. Certainly the largest amount of tax subsidization that is going on is for employer-sponsored coverage, because that is the way that most people get their health insurance. And but it's just a very complicated system, and I think the other challenge that we face is that, as you say, I mean, state governments, they don't want to raise taxes, right? So they're resorting to these provider taxes. And I think state governments are going to face even more challenges in the years ahead. And that's why we really need some federal action here. The reality is that people's health care costs, their health care needs and their long-term care needs aren't going to go away. So
no.
That's the bottom line. And then the cost, as you know, gets shifted to other payers in the system. So unless we get at some of the underlying pricing issues, we've just got folks who need health care and we have an aging population. So that's just a huge challenge we face.
Well, it's really ominous when you consider that in Louisiana, 41% of our population is on Medicaid. These are staggering numbers. I mean, staggering, and if there's a 10% tweak by the federal government, I don't know what the state does from a budgetary standpoint. And, thankfully there's a period of time with the big, beautiful bill provisions before a lot of this is implemented in our rurals. Our own healthcare folks here are saying it could be 3 years before there's an impact and we have to figure out something in between. But separate and apart from that, I mean, there's going to be a day of reckoning, and I'm not sure that anybody's really ready for it. Do you?
Well,
I don't see it.
I think you're right. And as we talked about up top, a lot of these changes are delayed till after the midterm elections or after the next presidential election. And so, I think we've got some rough waters ahead.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Joan Halker, as always, thank you so much for your time, your insight. Truly appreciated. Executive Director for the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy. Have a great week.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. So just to follow up on some of the provisions of the bill, there was an interview of Jeff Reynolds, who's the executive director of the Rural Hospital Coalition of Louisiana, and they represent 49 rural hospitals in 41 different parishes, and talking about what he saw as the provisions and what they actually would provide for. And as was pointed out by Joan Alker, that one of the immediate provisions is the capping of the provider taxes at the rate that they are at, I think is 6%, and it will be reduced to either 3.5 or 3, if my memory serves me correct. And that will kick in later years, really starting in, in about 2028. So we got about 2 years out before a lot of those provisions come into place. And at that point in time, things will get very, very interesting, right, as it relates to the funding of this. A lot of the other provisions come into effect in the spring of 2027, as well as 28, and then some start in 2029. And so for the next 4 to 5 years, what Jeff Reynolds was saying is that he believes that we're actually fine as it relates to the financing here in the state of Louisiana. But then it gets dicey, right? And carrying through to fiscal year 2035, of course, a lot can happen between now and then. But one of the interesting observations that was made is, and it's true, that as the payer mix is the way they refer to it, if there's a tightening on Medicaid and Medicare, typically what happens is that commercial insurance costs go up, premium costs. So you end up paying more premium. And already medical inflation is in the double digits. And then you add to that this shifting of the financing of healthcare in this country, and those young folks that are entering the workforce and those in the midst of the workforce, they end up paying a lot more for their coverage. In fact, so much more in some areas, it, unless they're part of a large group or otherwise, it gets cost prohibitive to even work in the type of business that they're working in any longer. This is something that needs to be addressed, and it's why we talk a lot about it here on this show. We don't hear a lot of solutions. We hear a lot of, you know, complaining about what is actually out there at the present time. The drug costs, we got to knock them down. It's killing us. The delivery of health care, the manner in which we're doing now, is not working. You know, it may be that we're trying to finance too much with too little. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll talk about the case for and against a Fed cut, auto troubles in the American auto industry, part two. We'll talk about some more fraudulent schemes that are out there as well, the current state of tariffs and the Cambodian-Thailand conflict and what that means. We'll be right back with Guy Williams. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL.